Proceed to the sixth case, the United States versus Emerson. Ms. Smith.
Good morning, gentlemen. Your Honor. May it please the court. Mr. Lloyd. I would like your honor this morning to remove yourself for a moment from the rarefied air of our Court of Appeals up here in Chicago, if you would, and place yourself in the position of being both a defendant and a defense attorney in the main streets of East St. Louis, Illinois, and how it works down there in the trenches.
Which are you?
Well, the defense attorney at this point, Judge.
Oh, that's good. Well, I didn't think anybody's going to go in combination here.
And I understand there's some legal issues here, and they've been briefed by both sides very well. And as a preliminary point, I would like to say that Mr. Lloyd and I have been practicing together, I think, 12 years. We've had many trials together. And though I take the government on and assert that the government operated in maybe bad faith and did not maintain the integrity and the fairness of the judicial system here, I have nothing but respect for Mr. Lloyd. And he and I he's beaten me every time we've been in court, I think, every time we've gone to trial. So this isn't any reflection on him. That's where I started off my introduction this morning, to try to put yourself in the place of my client and myself. And I think it's borne out by the records and the uncontested exhibits that are attached below. My client gets indicted. He has a choice of pleading straight up, going to trial, or pleading guilty and cooperating. He cooperates. He provides information, the proffer. The proffer is accepted before the government offers a cooperating plea agreement, of course. Otherwise, the government would be acting in bad faith and inducing my client to waive his appellate rights, waive his collateral attack rights, and not have any promise or not have any promise of a future Rule 35 touch. So when a defendant enters a cooperating plea agreement with the possibility of a Rule 35 or a 5K in the motion in the future to cut his sentence down for his cooperation, the government acted there in good faith. So time goes on, I write some letters, and those are exhibits in there, showing that that's what my client and I assume is the posture of this case. Including, by the way, my client's wife and his mother and the whole family. So he goes off to prison, Your Honors, and I start getting phone calls, when's happening with the Rule 35, what's going on with the Rule 35, and I'm assuming that the proffer's been accepted, that we are in the posture of the case of either how much of a cut in a sentence he's going to get for his cooperation and the information he gave to the government, or if that information he gave was substantial enough. I do not think at all that the issue is that my client lied or that did not tell the truth to the agents. You can tell that from the letters below, and the letters of my client, the letters to the government. And my proffer notes, you can see what the information my client gave. He spilled his guts about everything he'd ever done since he was in kindergarten. So he told everything he did, and the uncontested record below indicates that. So this year goes on, Your Honors, and I start getting phone calls from my client, his wife, his mom, what's happening with his Rule 35? So I write a letter to Mr. Lloyd, to the government, and say, what's going on? Here's the information he gave. Are you going to get a file? And of course, the government does file the placeholder Rule 35 within that one-year time period. Then a month or two after that, I get the copy of the ATF report. And my Rule 35 for my client's on hold, and the ATF report comes back and is wrong, totally wrong, about the participants who participated in the proffer of information by my client, the date, the substance of the proffer, and even where the proffer occurred. And that's also spelled out in the uncontested facts below. I try to bring these issues before the government by letters that were sent to the case agents, sent to not only the AUSA involved in this case, but his boss. I've made numerous phone calls, and I get nothing back in response from the government trying to clear up the fact that my client didn't lie. His proffer had been accepted. And of course, I'm still getting the phone calls from my clients and my client's family. So what's going on? I did what I could. I gave information. Am I going to get a cut or not, and how much of a cut am I going to get? And all of a sudden, I have to turn around and tell my client, they say you lied 16 months ago, and they didn't accept your proffer. Now, and that's clearly not the record. That's clearly not what happened. And I demonstrated that in the document that was submitted to the district court. So my client is in the, and I'm in this posture, now what do we do? We're not getting any response back from the agents or from the government trying to clear up the misunderstanding, the difference in opinion, whether my client lied and didn't give a good proffer, his proffer's not accepted, or whether he didn't.
Was all the cooperation before the plea agreement?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Was there any contact subsequent to that that he was questioned or brought in or inquire about certain things he said and part of a further investigation?
No, Your Honor, but if you recall from the record below, there were appointments made by the government agents to go into more details about the big picture of his criminal activity he'd given. That was canceled by the agents, both of those follow-up proffers.
Were you included in that conference? Or
yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Yes, and my calendar notes show that. In fact, one of my letters to my client show that, here's the next scheduled proffer. They want to go into more details about the big picture of the information he gave. The agents got too busy, and you can see that in one of my notes to myself. The agent said, we'll get back to you if we have more time. They had too many breaking cases. And frankly, in the trenches, Judge Mannion, that happens often. The agents have too much going on. They get this intelligence. They have it there. And sometimes they can utilize it, sometimes they can't. Sometimes they've got more important cases to move on to, and they never get back to our clients. They never get back to maybe go into more detail or to start targeting more of the people that one of our clients gave information on.
Well, does this stuff get stale then because of these, we'll call them unavoidable delays?
Your Honor, as I indicated in my February 2003 affidavit, I sat in on many other proffers with many other clients, and I knew from those proffers that two of the people that my client had provided information on and had dealt drugs with in April of 2001 when he gave his first proffer, they were still out on the street selling drugs and doing criminal activity basically as of February of 2003. And that's included in my notarized affidavit before. So the point that I was trying to unjam his logjam and trying to get the government to say, oh, we made a mistake, this ATF report was wrong, I knew, as a matter of fact, from other proffers that, and from the other attorney's office, the other attorneys in my office, that in fact two of these people were still out selling drugs, and they could have been targeted, and they still could have been used. So that information was not stale at that point, Judge. And what happened, of course, Judge, is that I wasn't getting a response from the government or from the supervisor of the criminal division at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Fairview Heights. I finally was forced into the posture of dropping it and not doing anything and letting my client and his family feel like, what happened here? Our proffer was accepted. We didn't want to enter a cooperating plea agreement. You told me it was accepted. The agent told you it was accepted. Or do I do something? And I was forced into the position for the first time in my life, with no hopes of winning it, Judge, of filing a motion with the district court, asking the district court to go ahead and grant the Rule 35 motion the government had already filed. Now, I knew the district court, and I know the law, both of the Supreme Court, this circuit, every circuit in the country. It's not up to the district court. They can't grant a Rule 35. The government has to make the motion. The government has to proceed with that motion. But I was forced in that posture of making that motion and attaching all my exhibits. And I'm going to use up some of my rebuttal time, if I may, because I wanted to do something in this case, and I just let it lapse and nothing else happened. So I filed that motion asking the district court to grant the Rule 35 motion. And why I did that is because it was just sitting there. Nothing else was going to happen unless I did something like that. The government immediately filed its motion saying, oh, we're not even talking about him lying anymore. We're just saying he didn't give us enough information. And so the government originally, in the ATF report, stood by the fact that my client had lied and not provided any good information, and then switched around, changed its story to the district court and said, oh, it wasn't substantial enough. And of course, the court says clearly the government's decision to make the decision whether it's substantial or not, but they changed the story. So then at that point is when I filed the motion asking for an evidentiary hearing to resolve these contested facts below and give my client some satisfaction and give my client's family and his wife some satisfaction. And at that point, that's why we're here on appeal. We did not get the evidentiary hearing, of course, and issues about the substantial threshold showing and what the legitimate government interests are briefed in my brief. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mr. Lloyd.
I was one of the attorneys that handled this case. This was a joint prosecution. We had a special assistant from the Madison County State's Attorney's Office who was made a special assistant because the case originated in Madison County. The defendant lives in St. Clair County. The St. Clair County Drug Task Force did the proffer in this case, along with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and along with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. It's the government's position that initially what Mr. Smith said is true. It was initial acceptance of the proffer. It was the determination of the Sheriff's Department and the FBI that they wanted to get the defendant to do some proactive work. It was not until sometime later that it came to the government's attention, about the time that the Rule 35 a year period was about to end, that I needed to do additional investigation to see if there was anything for which to give the defendant a Rule 35. It's the position of the government that this appeal should be dismissed. A plea agreement is a contract. There's an offer, an acceptance, and it's consideration on both sides. There was no promise in this plea agreement to give the defendant a Rule 35. This is not like U.S. versus Lozine, where in that case the government said that the government shall give the defendant a Rule 35 if there's substantial assistance. In our plea agreement, it says the government may give a Rule 35 within the sole discretion of the United States. The plea in this case complied with Rule 11. The defendant waived his rights to appeal, to make a collateral attack on the sentence. The terms of the plea agreement were expressed and unambiguous. In the defendant's reply brief, she argues that there was a denial of an evidentiary hearing, essentially a procedural due process argument, and also states that there was no rational relation between the government's conduct and a legitimate government end, basically a substantive due process argument.
So could I focus for a moment on some dates?
Yes, Your Honor.
We have a plea in May 24th of 2001.
That's correct.
And the government files its motion, 35 motion, in August of 2002. So we've got 16 months later.
Well, from the date of the
plea,
from the date of the sentencing, the date would run.
Well, when was the sentencing? Well, I understand the timeline, but I'm assuming he made the proffer before he pled, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. So I want to get into how it all works in the district. So in May, or at least sometime before May, there's a discussion with Emerson. A proffer is made.
That's correct.
At least 16 months later, the government has reflected that something caused you to file the Rule 35.
Well, I filed the what we call a placeholder motion.
Yes.
Basically out of respect for defense counsel, and also to determine whether or not there had been any cooperation upon
okay.
which to grant a Rule 35. I did not want to violate the rights of the defendant, the one-year period run,
sure.
without
sure.
finding out whether or not there had been any definitive assistance.
Yeah, but the government doesn't withdraw it until Emerson makes this motion to grant, which I understand is, as Ms. Smith says, is just she just did it to get some action. Is that what triggered the withdrawal of the 35? Her request to.
In about that time, I had contacted the FBI agent who had since located and in fact had. Relocated to Chicago. The ATF agent has since relocated to a head office in Macon, Georgia, and leaving only the two local officers in St. Clair County, Deputy Sheriff Effersman and Deputy Sheriff Clark. But it took some time to get all these parties together. I faxed them copies of all the materials that Ms. Smith had provided to the government, asked them to evaluate them and connect with the answer. And I asked each of them individually. Not I didn't want them to get together to come up with a consensus answer. I wanted to talk to each of them individually and get their input. And based upon their input, it was the governor's decision that there was no substantial assistance in this case.
Ms. Smith, I don't want to go outside the record, references her obvious long-term professional relationship with the office and you in particular. Any phone calls between you?
Yes, we did have some phone calls during this period of time. I'm not a person who writes a great deal of letters. Because I do have a professional relationship with I do conduct a lot of my business by telephone. It was not until the Senate filed the motion trying to force the government to file a Rule 35, which would have been improvident based upon the fact that the government filed its motion asking the court to withdraw the Rule 35.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important in this case that the court deal with the motion to dismiss this appeal. I think this court in the Behrman case noted that even a constitutional right could be waived in a plea agreement. Of course, there are certain arguments that cannot be waived, like ineffective assistance of counsel, which goes to the heart validity of the plea agreement, or whether or not the plea agreement was involuntary. In this case, there's no evidence, no argument that the plea was involuntary, no argument that the government used the possibility of a Rule 35 to get the defendant to plead. In fact, by the government putting in may possibly grant a Rule 35, all we're doing is tracking the statute. Rule 35D says that the government may file a motion with the court asking for a reduction. The same with 18 U.S.C. 3553E for downward departure.
Now, we're all satisfied after talking to the police officers involved, there was no substantial aid given from the defendant to you.
Pardon, Your Honor?
That there was no substantial help given to law enforcement by the defendant.
That's correct, Your Honor. There was no furtherance of any investigation that was pending at that time.
Do you think he gave you all he had?
Your Honor, I would submit to the court, I don't believe that he did get all he had because a few days prior to the plea, we revoked his bond, and I think that was one of the circumstances that led the officers down the road to say that this defendant was not cooperating.
Okay. The cooperation that he was to extend was before the plea?
No, it was.
It was after the plea.
It was going to be. It was a continuing. Our plea agreement encompasses the cooperation after the plea.
Right.
Because this was a felon in possession case. It was a reacting case, a fairly fast case. And the drug cases usually take a lot more time to work on.
Mm.
We anticipated that any.
But you don't think he gave you all the candid information that he had to assist you?
No, Your Honor, I do not. I will submit that my time's up.
No, you have a minute.
Okay. You know, it's the government's position that the motion dismissed should be granted. In alternative, the court's order denying a remedy to the defendant in this case should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Lloyd. Ms. Smith. I think you have a minute. I don't want to bargain with you.
Your Honor, I have to repeat. Defendants in the Southern District of Illinois absolutely do not get a cooperating plea agreement unless the decision has already been made by the agents and the prosecutor that the client, the defendant, has told the truth and he's told everything that they think he knows and everything that they think he knows at that point. He hasn't held anything back. I have an affidavit in the record below attesting that fact. That's based on my 12 years down in Southern District of Illinois with hundreds of clients and all the other attorneys in our office who practice that way. We do not get a cooperating plea agreement unless you tell the truth and the agents have made that preliminary determination, or we do not get one. So, when, in any event, that addresses one of the questions that was raised by your Honor, Judge Bauer, Justice Bauer. So, I think the issue goes back again. Did he lie? Or did the government change its story and say, oh, he didn't give substantial assistance? You read the ATF report, it says he lied. He was not truthful.
Well, he lied by saying, I don't know anything more. That could be a lie.
Your Honor, if you read my notes to the proffer, he went back to...
I understand.
What's the evidence of an unconstitutional motive here, or some sort of irrational conduct by the government? Don't we have to have that because of this enormous discretion that the government possesses with regard to the filing of these 35 motions?
Well, unconstitutional, of course, would be race or gender, creed, whatever, along those lines. But it's also the Bishop Court and the Supreme Court in Wade said it's not rational in terms of what a legitimate governmental interest is. My contention is that the legitimate governmental interest here is maintain the fairness and integrity of the federal criminal judicial system. My client feels like he's been shafted by the government. He's telling everybody in prison right now that's what happened to him and his family.
They all believe it, so you don't have to worry about that. He isn't making any hamburgers, they're already sold.
But you know what? I never try to send my clients off thinking they've been messed over by the government.
They can figure it out. They get that idea all by themselves.
No,
I don't think you give them that idea.
No, Judge, I try to say, look, they did what they did. They did, you said that you broke the law. This is where you're sitting because you broke the law.
Right.
In this case, he's telling his friends he didn't get back out of prison. He's telling his friends, his family thinks that. And he knows he told the truth. He knows that I told him they told the truth. He knows that the agents told him that his proffer was accepted. And all of a sudden, it's a different page. The deal did not go down like he thought it was going to go down. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement and the court will stand in recess.